Getting to grips with the language brought him no closer to understanding the origins of the Shishkoda civilization. The Shishkoda never alluded to what had happened in their collective past and appeared to have no concept of ancient history, their own or anyone else's. For example, they either didn't grasp or considered irrelevant the fact that Jesus walked the earth several thousand years ago. It might as well have been last week. In this, they were, of course, excellent Christians. "Tell me about Kurtzberg," he asked them.
"Kurtzberg gone."
"Some of the workers at USIC say cruel things about that. I think they're not serious, but I can't be sure. They say you killed him."
"Kill him?"
"Made him dead, like the Romans made Jesus dead."
"Jesus not dead. Jesus alive."
"Yes, but he was killed. The Romans beat him and nailed him to the cross, and he died."
"God is a miracle. Jesus no longer dead."
"Yes," agreed Peter. "God is miracle. Jesus no longer dead. But what happened to Kurtzberg? Is he alive too?"
"Kurtzberg alive."
A dainty gloved hand gestured at the empty landscape.
"Walking, walking, walking, walking."
Another voice said,
"He leave us in need of him."
Another voice said,
"You no leave us."
"I will have to go home eventually," he said. "You understand that?"
"Home here."
"My wife is waiting for me," he said.
"Your wife be?"
"Yes," he said.
"Your wife be one. We are many."
A very John Stuart Mill observation. At this, they twitched their shoulders in fretful incomprehension. He should have known better than to say it. The Shishkoda did not do witticism or irony, so why had he bothered? Maybe he was saying it to be, as if she were here to hear. Solemn truth. If B hadn't been okay, he wouldn't have come. He would have postponed his visit, stayed at the base. The disappointment his flock would have felt was a far less serious thing than the distress of the woman he loved. But to his enormous relief, she had listened to his pleas and prayed. And of course, God had come through. "I went to bed frightened and angry and lonely, I must confess," she'd written to him. "I was expecting to wake up in a state of suppressed panic as usual, my arms folded around my face to ward off whatever nasty surprise the day had in store for me. But next morning, the whole world was different." Yes, that's what God could do. B had always known that, but she'd forgotten it, and now she knew it again. "I may have mentioned, but probably not," her morning after prayer letter went on, "that the central heating has been gurgling slash thumping slash stuttering all day and night for weeks, and suddenly the house was quiet. I figured the boiler must have given up the ghost, but no, it was fine. Everything working smoothly, as if God just laid a finger on it and said, behave yourself. Joshua seemed more at ease, stroking himself against my shins the way he used to. I made a cup of tea and realized I had no morning sickness. Then there was a knock on the door. I thought it was the postman, until I remembered that deliveries have been coming in the afternoon, if they've come at all. But it was four fresh-faced young men, maybe mid-twenties, very macho. For a moment I was scared they might rape me and rob me. A lot of that's been going on lately. But guess what? They wanted to remove the piles of stinking garbage. They had a four-wheel drive and a trailer. Their accents were Eastern European, I think. They've been driving all over the area doing this.
The system is gone to hell,
one of them said, big grin on his face.
We are the new system.
I asked them how much they're charging. I expected them to say 200 quid or something.
Give us £20. And a bottle of some kind of nice drink.
I told them I didn't have any alcohol in the house.
Then give us £30. And think in your mind that we are good, strong, amazing guys.
They cleared the lot in 2 minutes flat. They were showing off, tossing heavy bags into the trailer with one hand, doing a leapfrog on the wheelie bins, stuff like that. It was bitter weather. I was shivering in a parka, and these guys were in thin sweatshirts, skin tight, so that their muscles were well displayed.
We come to your rescue, yeah? Every day you think, when is somebody gonna come? And today, we come. Don't trust the government. It is bullshit. They say you want the mess cleaned up, but it's too much problem. Bullshit. It's not problem. 5 minutes work. Good strong guys. Finished.
He was beaming, sweating. He seemed perfectly warm. I gave them a £50 note. They gave me 20 change, then drove off with the garbage, waving bye-bye. The street looked and smelled civilized for the first time in weeks. I wanted to tell someone what had just happened, so I phoned Claire. I almost didn't. I've hardly used the phone for ages. There's been this hideous crackling on the line. You can barely hear the other person. But this time, it was totally noise-free. Again, I thought it must be dead, but it was just working as it should. Claire was not surprised by my news. She's heard about these guys. They make a fortune, she says, because they visit maybe 40 homes every day at £20 a pop. Funny how a service you're accustomed to paying a few pence for, in tax, suddenly seems cheap at 100 times the price. Anyway, the story gets better. Claire said she'd had a strong mental picture of me ever since she went to bed last night, as if someone beamed it into my head, she said. She and Keith are moving to Scotland. They got a third of what they originally paid for their house and feel lucky to have sold it. To a much smaller, scummier, Claire's word, place, because at least they have a support network there. Anyway, they packed up their possessions and Claire decided she no longer needs half the clothes she's accumulated over the years. So, rather than putting them into a charity bin, which is risky nowadays because people use them for garbage, she brought over 3 huge bin bags full.
Take whatever you want for yourself, BB. The rest can go to the church, she said.
When I opened the bags, I almost cried. Claire is exactly the same size as me, if you recall. You probably don't. And I've always loved to taste in clothes. I'm not a covetous person, but there were things in those bags that I used to lust after when I'd see Claire wearing them. Well, I'm wearing one of them right now. A lilac cashmere pullover that's so soft you keep touching it to make sure it's real. It must have cost 10 times more than anything I've ever had on my body, apart from my wedding dress. And there are fancy leggings as well. Beautifully embroidered, works of art. If you were here, I would give you a little fashion parade. Can you even remember what I look like? No, don't answer that. I start back at work tomorrow. Rebecca tells me that Goodman has gone on holiday. Is that good news or what? And my hand has healed up very nicely. There was still some tingling in the nerves before, but that's completely gone now. I went out to the supermarket today, and there was more stock on the shelves than there's been for ages. I remarked on it to the manager, and he gave me such a smile. We aim to please, he said. I suddenly realised what a nightmare he's been living through. It's only a lousy supermarket, but it's his baby. Speaking of which, did I already mention no morning sickness? Just cravings, cravings, cravings. But in the supermarket, I scored, wait for it, I certainly have, a chocolate dessert. I suppose it's kind of trivial to claim that God delivers chocolate when you really, really want it. But maybe he does. Chocolate and cashmere pullovers. Weirdly exotic things they seem to him under the vast sky of Oasis, observing the incremental progress of Kikirch from horizon to horizon. And of course, he'd been reminded of Matthew 6:25 when he'd read B's letter. But he knew she was touchy lately and might not appreciate being reminded of Jesus' cautions against getting too concerned with food and clothes. The main thing was that she felt encouraged and restored. She'd been in danger of slipping adrift from God's protection, and now she was back in it. "Thank you, thank you, thank you, Lord," he prayed. He trusted she was doing the same. Yusik had promised him that they would build a transmitter for chute access right near his church very soon, maybe even before his next visit to C2. So this was the last time he would be out in the field without the chance to share his day-to-day impressions with B. Once the chute was in place, neither of them would be unreachable anymore. B's mention of Claire and Keith troubled him slightly. He couldn't remember ever having met them. Were they members of the church or acquaintances from somewhere else? People from B's hospital? She spoke as though their identity didn't need explaining. Claire, apparently, had a body almost identical to B's. He strained to recall seeing his wife standing next to another female who looked very similar. A woman in a lilac cashmere pullover. Nothing came. Jesus Lover 9 padded over to him, cradling a small pot of white flower sweetmeats. She angled the pot forward to indicate, "Have some." He took one. It was delicious, but marinated in a saucy paste that left dark brown marks on the fingers. Lover 9's gloves were filthy. They would need washing when she got home. Her robe was grubby too. Quite a few of the Shishkoda were a bit soiled today, because before the language lesson, they'd been digging a hole for the transmitter. Even Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these, he thought. The communion came to an end, and the Shishkoda went back to their homes, and Peter went into his church and slept for a spell. How long? A while. A while. He'd lost touch with whether it was technically day or night, or 2200 plus, or whatever stupid formula the Yusik people expected him to use. But he was attuned to the rhythms of the Shishkoda by now, and when he awoke, he had a sense that it must be very early morning, and it probably was. A shaft of light illuminated his lower body, emphasizing the sharp contours of his pelvis and the concave valley under his ribcage. He was all bone and sinew, like a dancer or an inmate of a concentration camp. The taut flesh pulsed with his heartbeat. He wasn't hungry, though, just thirsty. The light was flickering on his abdomen. Why was it flickering? Rain must be on the way. He decided to leave the water bottle untouched by his pillow and to wait for the heavens to open instead. Outside, naked, he stood watching, his hair flapping with the force of what was approaching. It would be a particularly heavy downpour, he could tell. Four gigantic bodies of water, stacked in a vast pyramidal formation, rolled forward, constantly threatening to merge into one, but somehow remaining discreet. Three of them swirled in slow, stately fashion, and the fourth spun with centrifugal frenzy. Best to hold tight to something. He braced himself against the wall. When the deluge hit, it was exhilarating but also scary. The wind rushed past him through the church, and he heard the thump and clatter of loose objects being thrown about. One gust almost lifted him off his feet, but the rain was cool and clean and luxurious. He opened his mouth and let it pour in. He felt as though he was diving and swimming, and surfacing, always surfacing, without having to move a muscle. When it was over, he was dazed and numb and unsteady on his feet. A cursory inspection of the church interior showed no serious damage. Jesus Lover 17's painting, a recent arrival he hadn't yet had time to attach to the ceiling, had been hurled across the floor, and the edges of its cloth were frayed. But the picture was unharmed. An expressionist still life of a flower he'd thought at first, but no. What he'd perceived as flower petals was a circle of robed figures, bent backward in astonishment. And what he'd perceived as the stamen was a man growing from the ground. Lazarus. He stowed the painting back behind the pulpit, ready for hanging. The rainburst had left him pleasantly sated, and his natural inclination was to lie down and allow his skin to tingle for a while. But he knew there was work to be done. Not the Lord's work, but manual labor. The white flower fields would be sodden, and within a couple of hours, many of the plants would have swelled to maturity, while others would be in danger of collapsing into sludge. The time to act was now.
God bless our reunion, Father Peter.
He waved, but wasted no time saying hello to everyone he knew. Many of the Shishkode gathered here for the harvest were not Jesus lovers, and they had yet to accept him fully in their midst. It was diplomatic to save the conversation for later. He got down on his knees, and within seconds, his hands were caked to the elbows with muck. The plantation had turned into one big bog, like a pig farm. The soil was more retentive of moisture here than in the open scrublands, and there was also a lot of decaying white flower scattered about from the remnants of plants that had been uprooted last time. A fine, almost imperceptible fog began to rise from the ground, rendering everything less than fully distinct. It didn't matter. The plant in front of you, that was all you needed to see. Peter enjoyed working in the fields. It took him back to his younger days of strawberry picking for cash in hand, except that this was honest toil, and he wasn't doing it because he was on the run from drug buddies he'd robbed. It wasn't mindless drudgery either, because you had to evaluate each plant to decide whether to leave it alone, tear bits off it, squeeze it, or pull it out. The Shishkode harvested patiently and with quiet deliberation, more like gardeners than slave-driven serfs. They wore their gloves as usual. Whenever these became too muddy, they would stop for a while to wipe them free of excess dirt or adjust the fit. Sometimes they just sat back and rested for a few minutes. When they'd accumulated a basketful of plants, they would carry it to the edge of the field, where half a dozen nets were spread out. Onto these nets, they would distribute the different parts of the plants, each part according to its destiny. It had taken Peter quite a while to get the hang of which bits went on which pile, but he believed he had it sorted now. He was no longer a liability. He was a fellow worker, and he worked harder and faster than any of them. After an hour or two, despite the fact that there were probably still lots of moribund plants hiding in amongst the resilient ones, the harvesters, mindful of their limited energy, moved on to the next phase. This was the part Peter liked best, because it really did require vigour and stamina, two qualities the Shishkode were not overly endowed with. They were all right at carrying the produce from the fields back into the settlement, but each net could be carried as slowly and as haltingly and by as many people as the weight of its contents demanded. But there was a task which allowed no slack, the making of meat. Beefsteak, lamb, bacon, veal. Cunning simulacra of these were favourites among the largely carnivorous USIC personnel, but they weren't easy to create. They required violent effort, not the killing of an animal, but the relentless pounding of white flower plants that were on the brink of death. Only the most swollen, senile specimens were chosen. When the water-gorged flesh was pummeled with a stone, the weakened capillaries of the plant diffused a characteristic flavour through the pulpy mess. With each pound, the mess became more elastic and homogeneous, until it could be left to solidify into dense lumps which, when carved and seasoned, looked and tasted uncannily like meat. The Shishkode pummeled gingerly, one or two blows at a time. Peter pummeled like a machine. So absorbed were Peter and the Shishkode in their work that they didn't notice, until it was too late, the arrival of the swarm. One of the Shishkode shouted something Peter half understood, because it contained the same root word for foreign / alien / unexpected / strange that was in the Book of Strange New Things. Smiling in pleasure at this further proof of his progress in the language, he looked to where the person was pointing. At the perimeter of the plantation, barely discernible as anything more than a low mist of pinky grey, was the horde of bird-like creatures Peter had seen marching past the USIC base. His first impulse was to whoop with delight and urge his friends to enjoy the spectacle. But the Shishkode were obviously alarmed, and with good reason. The creatures waddled silently into the white flower, and within seconds, a large swathe of the field was obscured by their quivering bodies. Peter ran through the fields to get a closer look, but he already knew. These animals, these adorable critters, these chickadees, duckaboos, woglets, or whatever other cute names they might be given, were rapacious vermin, and they were here to eat the crop. Mindless as maggots, they hunkered into the juicy white flower, making no distinction between old plants and young plants, hard buds and flaccid leaves, flower or stalk. In their downy grey heads, muscles pulsed as they chewed and chomped. Their spherical bodies shivered and swelled and were not satisfied. Instinctively, he reached down and seized the nearest of them and yanked it free of its feast. At once, his forearm got an electric shock. Or that's how it felt, as the frantic creature lunged round and clamped its fangs into his flesh. He hurled it away in an arc of his own blood. He tried kicking at the creatures, but he was bare-legged apart from his sandals, and a vicious bite on one of his calves sent him reeling backward. There were too many of them anyway. If he'd had a cudgel, or a gun, a machine gun, or a fucking flamethrower. Adrenaline connected him with the younger, angrier Peter, a pre-Christian Peter, who was capable of punching a man's nose until it splintered, capable of smashing the windscreen of a car, capable of sweeping a long row of fragile knick-knacks off a mantelpiece in a convulsive gesture of hatred. Except that he was capable of nothing now, and his adrenaline was useless, because all he could do was fall back and watch this horde consume the fruits of his people's labor. Those of the Shishkoda who weren't Jesus lovers had better things to do than stand and watch. The fate of their plantation was obvious. They hurried to the piles of harvested white flour and shouldered the nets, heaving them off the ground. They knew that the pests would eat systematically from one end of the field to the other, so there was still time to carry away what was already in the bag, so to speak. The Jesus lovers swayed anxiously back and forth, torn between their need to salvage the crop and their concern for Peter. He approached them, intending to help them carry the load, but they cringed and swayed all the more. A weird, disturbing sound issued from their heads, a sound he hadn't heard before. Intuition told him it was the sound of lamentation. His arm, stretched out toward them, dripped blood into the soil. The bite was not just a puncture, but had lifted a flap of skin. His leg, too, was grisly.
"You will die. You will die,"
moaned Jesus Lover 5. "Why? Are those things poisonous?"
"You will die. You 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 will die."
Several of the Jesus lovers had joined in the moaning. Their raised voices jumbled together, so different from their usual gentle utterances, never spoken out of turn, unnerved him. "Poison?" he asked loud and clear, pointing at the swarm of vermin. He wished he knew the Shishkoda word for poison.
"Bad medicine?"
But they did not reply. Instead, they hurried away. Only Lover 5 hesitated. She'd been in a strange state all through the harvest, hardly working, mostly watching, occasionally lending just one hand, her left, to a simple task. Now she came to him, walking as if drunk or in a daze. She laid her hands, one glove grubby, the other clean, on his hips, then pressed her face hard into his lap. There was nothing sexual in her intent. He doubted if she even knew where or what his genitals were. He guessed she was saying goodbye. And then she was hurrying after the others. Within minutes, he stood alone in the white flower fields, his injured arm and leg itching and burning, his ears filled with the hideous noise of hundreds of rodent mouths gnashing on slimy pulp that only a few minutes before had been destined for transformation into bread, lamb, bean curd, ravioli, onion, mushroom, pinasht, butter, chocolate, soup, sardine, chinnamon, and a host of other things. When Peter limped back to his church, he found a pickup truck parked outside and a USIC employee called Conway sipping from a $50 bottle of pop. A short, bald man in immaculate lime green overalls and polished black boots, he cut a remarkable contrast to Peter's filthy, blood-spattered appearance.
"Are you okay?"
said Conway, then laughed at the absurdity of the question.
"I got bitten," said Peter.
"By what?"
I don't know what word you guys finally decided on. Flabbits? Chickadees? Whatever."
Conway raked a hand through his non-existent hair. He was an electrical engineer, not a medic. He pointed behind the church at a brand new structure that resembled a washing machine with a miniature Eiffel Tower stuck on top.
"Your chute relay," he explained.
In normal circumstances, copious expressions of thanks and admiration would have been in order, and Peter could see that Conway was having trouble letting go of his moment of well-deserved praise.
"I think I'd better get some treatment for this," said Peter, holding up his gory forearm.
"I think maybe you better,"
agreed Conway. By the time they reached the USIC base hours later, the bleeding had stopped, but the flesh around his wounds was turning dark blue. Necrosis? Probably just bruising. The vermin's jaws had punched him with the force of a power tool. During the drive, he'd had ample opportunity to examine his arm, and he couldn't see any bone peeping out. So he supposed the injury could be classified as superficial. He tucked the loose flap of skin back into place, but he guessed it would need stitches to stay there.
"We got us a new doctor," said Conway. "Just arrived."
"Oh, yes,"
said Peter. He was losing sensation in his mangled leg.
"Nice guy, and good at his job, too."
It seemed a fatuous remark to make. Everyone chosen by USIC was nice and good at their job.
"Glad to hear it."
"So,"
pursued Conway,
"let's go see him, now."
But Peter refused to go straight to the infirmary, insisting that he must first stop off in his quarters. Conway wasn't keen.
"It won't make any difference to the doctor how you're dressed," he pointed out. "And they'll clean you up with disinfectant and stuff."
"I know," said Peter. "I want to check for messages from my wife." Conway blinked in bemusement.
"Can it wait?" he said.
"No, it can't wait," said Peter.
"Okay,"
said Conway, and nudged the steering wheel. Unlike Peter, who couldn't distinguish one concrete facade from another, he knew exactly where to go. As soon as Peter walked into the USIC building, he was overcome with a fit of shivering. His teeth chattered as Conway led him to his quarters.
"You're not gonna keel over, are you?"
"I'm fine."
The atmosphere inside the complex was glacial. A vacuum laced with chilled, sterile oxygen, lacking any of the other natural ingredients that would have made it air. Each breath hurt his lungs. The light seemed bunker dim, ghastly. But didn't he always feel this way, whenever he'd been in the field for a while? He always needed to acclimatize. By the time they got to his room, Conway was very agitated indeed.
"I'll be right outside," he said. "Try to make it quick. I don't want a dead preacher on my hands."
"I'll do my best," said Peter, and shut him away from view.
Fever or some other disorder was swelling the vessels in his head, and his teeth were still chattering so hard that his cheeks and jaw ached. Dizziness and lethargy came in waves, trying to knock him off his feet. As he switched on the chute, he wondered if he was wasting precious seconds in which his life could be saved. But he doubted it. If the bite had poisoned him, USIC's medical clinic was unlikely to have an antidote. The poison would do whatever the poison was going to do, and it would either happen with a bunch of concerned faces hanging over him, or it would happen in the privacy of his own space. Maybe he had only hours to live. Maybe he would be the new pathologist's first challenge, a corpse full of alien venom. If so, he wanted, before he lost consciousness, to read just once more that B loved him and that she was okay. The chute glowed to life, and a small green light near the bottom of the screen winked on and off, indicating that an invisible net was sweeping through the universe to find any words that might be from his wife. Her message, when it came,
was brief. "There is no God," she wrote. Chapter 22. Alone with You by My Side.
"Carpenter," said a voice floating above him.
"Hmm?" he responded.
"When I was a kid, people assumed I'd be a carpenter. I had a talent for it, but then, this is all a con, you know."
"A con?"
"This air of sophistication medicine gets wrapped in. The doctor magician, the great master surgeon. Baloney. Fixing the human body doesn't require that much finesse. The skills you need, I tell you, it's just carpentry, plumbing, sewing."
Dr. Adkins was proving his point by pushing a sewing needle through Peter's flesh to add another loop of fine black thread to the row. He was almost done. The stitches formed an elegant design, like a tattoo of a swallow in flight. Peter felt nothing. He was generously dosed with analgesics on top of having been injected with 2 whacks of local anesthetic, and this, combined with his exhaustion, put him beyond the reach of pain.
"Do you think I've been poisoned?" he asked.
The operating theatre seemed to be expanding and contracting slightly, in rhythm with his pulse. "Nothing in your blood to suggest you have," said Adkins, tying the final knot.
"And what about, I forgot his name, the doctor you came here to, the one who died?"
"Everett."
"Everett, have you established what killed him?"
"Yup." Adkins tossed the needle onto the suture tray, which was immediately removed by Nurse Flores.
"Death."
Peter laid his embroidered arm across the white linen napkin, covering his chest. He wanted to sleep now.
"But the cause?"
Dr. Adkins pursed his lips. "A cardiovascular accident, with the emphasis on accident. His grandfather died the same way, apparently. These things happen. You can eat healthy foods, keep fit, take vitamins, but sometimes you just die. It's your time." He raised one eyebrow. "I guess you'd call it an appointment with God." Peter flexed his fingers, appraised his tattoo of stitches again.
"I thought it was my time for a while there."
Adkins chuckled.
"You'll live to preach another day. And when you go back, just in case you cross paths with those nasties again, here's my advice."
He clamped his hands together, mimed a violent swing.
"Take a golf club."
Peter was too drugged to walk, so someone trundled him out of the surgery in a wheelchair. 2 pale hands appeared from behind him and spread a cotton blanket over his knees, tucked it around his hips, deposited a transparent plastic bag containing his sandals in his lap.
"Thank you, whoever you are," he said.
"You're welcome, I'm sure," said Granger.
"Oh, gosh, I'm sorry," said Peter. "I didn't see you in the surgery."
She wheeled him, straight and steady, along the sunlit corridor toward the big double doors. "I was in the waiting room. I don't like the gory stuff." Peter lifted his arm, displayed the pure white bandage.
"All fixed up," he said.
Even before she replied, he could sense she was not impressed. Her wrists, gripping the handles of the wheelchair, were tense, tenser than they needed to be. "You don't take care of yourself when you're out there," she said. "For Christ's sake, you're skin and bone. And yeah, I know I'm blaspheming, but look at you." He stared down at his wrists, which had always been bony, he thought. Well, maybe not that bony. The thick bandage made his arm look more emaciated somehow. How angry was Granger? Just a bit exasperated? Furious? The distance between the medical center and his quarters would take several minutes to cover, which was a long time when you were in the hands of someone who was upset with you. Weakened by the analgesics and the shock of B's message, which returned to his mind over and over like a wave of nausea, he was suddenly overcome by a belief that other men had often described to him when he'd given them pastoral counseling. A deep, despondent conviction that no matter what they did,
no matter how good their intentions, they were doomed to bitterly disappoint women.
"Hey, I made an effort not to let my ears get so burnt this time," he said. "Give me some points for trying."
"Don't patronize me." Granger pushed him through the double doors, veered him sharply to the right. Kurtzberg was the same, she remarked. And Tartaglione. They looked like skeletons in the end. He sighed.
"We all look like skeletons in the end."
Granger grunted irritably. She wasn't finished chastising him yet. "What goes wrong out there in Freaktown? Is it you or them? They don't feed you, is that it? Or they just don't eat, period?"
"They're very generous," Peter protested. I've never felt that I'm being starved. It's just that they don't eat a lot themselves. I think most of what they grow and process gets put aside to feed the USIC personnel."
"Oh, great. So we're exploiting them now." Granger veered him round another corner. "I tell you, we've bent over backward to do the right thing here. Bent over backward. There's too much riding on this to fuck it up with an imperialist fiasco."
Peter wished they'd had this conversation a lot earlier, or that they could have saved it for later. Any time but now.
What's riding on this?"
he said, struggling to stay upright in the chair.
"Oh, for Christ's sake, isn't it obvious? Are you that much of a babe in the woods?"
"I just do God's work. My wife asks the penetrating questions," he was about to say.
It was true. B was always the one who needed to know why, who scratched under the veneer of what she was told, who refused to fall into step with the game everyone else was playing. She was the one who read the fine print in contracts. She was the one who would explain to him why an apparently wonderful opportunity was full of pitfalls. She was the one who could see through a scam, even if it came disguised in Christian wrapping. Granger was right. He was a babe in the woods.
He hadn't been born one, that's for sure.
He'd turned himself into one by force of will. There were many ways of becoming a Christian. But the way that had worked for him was to switch off his capacity for cynicism. Switch it off like a light. No, that was the wrong comparison. He'd switched on the light of trust. After so many years of playing games, exploiting everyone he met, stealing and lying and worse, he'd remade himself into an innocent. God had wiped the slate clean. The man had once littered his conversation with casual expletives like Jesus fucking Christ, became the man who said, "Gosh." There was no other way. You were either a raging alcoholic or you didn't touch drink. Same with cynicism. B could handle it in moderation. He couldn't. But then, there is no God. From B. Please, Lord, no. Not from B. B, too, had trundled him in a wheelchair once, in the hospital where they first met. Exactly like Granger was wheeling him now. He'd broken both his ankles jumping out of a warehouse window and had spent several days in B's ward with his legs strung up in the air. Then one afternoon, she unshackled him, got him into a wheelchair, and pushed him to the x-ray department for a post-op assessment.
"Can you just whiz me through one of these side exits for a minute so I can have a cigarette?" he'd said.
"You don't need nicotine, handsome," she'd replied from a sweet-smelling spot behind and above him. "You need your life to change."
"Well, here you are," said Granger.
"You're home away from home."
They'd reached the door that was labeled P. Lee, Pastor. As Granger was helping him to his feet, one of the USIC electricians, Springer, happened to be passing by.
"Welcome back, Preach," he called. "You want any more wool? You know where to find me."
And he sauntered on down the hall. Granger's lips were close to Peter's ear as she said softly,
"God, I hate this place and everybody who works here." "But please don't hate me," thought Peter, as he pushed open the door and they walked in together.
The atmosphere that greeted them was stale and slightly sour from 2 weeks' lack of air conditioning. Motes of dust, disturbed by the intrusion, swirled in a beam of light. The door fell shut. Granger, who'd had one arm on his back in case he lost his balance, threw the other one around him too. In his confusion, he was slow to realize she was embracing him. And not only that, it was a different embrace from the one they'd had before. There was passion and female need in it. "I care about you," she said, digging her forehead into his shoulder. "Don't die." He stroked her awkwardly. "I don't intend to." "You'll die. You'll die. I'll lose you. You'll go weird and distant, and then one day you'll just disappear." She was weeping now. "I won't. I promise."
"You bastard,"
she cried softly, holding him tighter still.
"You scumbag. You lying."
She broke the embrace. The pale fabric of her clothing was marked with dirt from the harvest fields of the Shishkoda.
"I won't drive you to see those freaks again," she said. "Someone else can do it."
"I'm sorry," he said. "Whatever you want." But she was already gone. There was no further message from B. At his command, a network of ingenious technologies searched the cosmos for her thoughts and found nothing. Only that same cry of desolation, still glowing on the screen. Just those four awful words, hanging in a contextless grey void. No name attached, neither hers nor his, just the raw sentence. He sat at the chute and prayed for strength. He knew that if he didn't reply now and keep it short, he was liable to pitch forward and go unconscious right there. His clumsy fingers were poised to type the words of Psalm 14:1. "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." But then God entered Peter's heart and cautioned him that this would be stupid. Whatever had happened to B, she didn't need criticism. Maybe there had been another natural disaster? Some horrific event in a foreign country that had swamped B's head with the pain of useless empathy? Or maybe it had happened closer to home, in Britain. A catastrophe that had left thousands of people homeless, devastated, bereaved? Psalms to the rescue again. "Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, nor for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday. 1,000 shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee." But what if? What if it had come nigh to be? What if she'd been hit by an earthquake or a flood? What if, right at this moment, she was stranded and dazed, camped in the ruins of their house? But no. No, be logical. Their house must be intact, or else she wouldn't be able to write to him. Usyk had given them a chute, and it was set up in the study upstairs, connected to a mainframe the size of a filing cabinet. The existence of B's message proved she was safe. Except that a person alienated from God could never be safe. As the hydromorphine, chloroprocaine, and exhaustion dragged him more and more insistently towards sleep, he began to panic. He must write, and yet he couldn't. He must say something, break the silence. And yet if he chose the wrong words, he would regret it forever. Finally, he let go of any notion of quoting Bible verses or giving advice. He was her husband. She was his wife. That was the only thing he could be sure of. "B, I don't know what's brought you to this point, but I love you and I want to help you if I can. Please tell me what's wrong and please forgive me if it's something I should have already known. I've just come out of surgery. A few stitches, nothing serious. I got bitten in the field. Explain later. We'll crash for a bit now, but please, I'm worried about you. I love you. I know this sounds absurd, but I'm there for you. I really am." He sent this flying and collapsed into bed. A little while later, without speaking, Granger came and lay next to him. She rested her head on his naked chest, and her shoulder was in such a position that it would have been unnatural not to cup it in his hand. So he cupped it in his hand.
She moved closer against him, let him feel the warmth of her flesh. Her small fingers stroked his abdomen. Her palm traced the hollow where the ribs began. Then she took hold of his penis, which was already erect. Before he could speak, B was there with them, reassuring him with her eyes that it was all right. Granger lifted her tunic. Her pale breasts were freckled. He kissed one while B finished undressing and crawled onto the bed. Granger held his penis upright, allowing B to lower herself onto it. He ejaculated the instant he was inside. As soon as he awoke, he smelled the odor of betrayal. He had committed adultery in his heart, and worse, dragged his wife into his disloyal fantasy, making her an accomplice. He and B had always been faithful to each other. He never took advantage of the vulnerable females who passed through his ministry. He was a one-woman man, and B was his woman. Wasn't she? He lay still for a while, shielding his eyes from the sunlight with his good arm. A hangover-style headache throbbed in his temples. His tongue and lips had dried out. His injured arm felt okay. Well, numb. But his shin hurt like a burn. He had no idea how long he'd slept. 15 minutes or 15 hours. A memory of the dream lingered, tempting him with its phantasm of love, its enchanted mirage in which all grief and hurt and estrangement were smoothed over by desire. Thirst pushed him to his feet. He drank greedily straight from the tap, noisy as a dog, until his stomach sloshed. The doctor had told him to go ahead and take showers, get soap and water on his wounds, but not scratch at the stitches if they got itchy. They would dissolve by themselves when their work was done. Peter unfastened and unrolled the bandages, unveiling the mended flesh. The soft white cotton was hardly stained at all, the injuries neat. He showered, toweled himself dry, carefully reapplied the bandages. He put on jeans and a faded orange t-shirt emblazoned Outreach Task Force Basildon. Both garments felt too big. He rummaged inside his knapsack for some socks, pulled out a small plastic bag with squishy, semi-liquid contents he couldn't identify at first. It was the remains of a meal he'd been given by the Shishoda a long time ago, before he'd grown accustomed to their food. A slab of suety stuff that tasted of vinegar. Loath to offend them, he claimed he wasn't hungry and would eat it later. The bag was a clammy weight in his palm, like an animal organ removed from a carcass. He looked around for somewhere conspicuous to put it, so that he wouldn't forget it again. On the table next to the fridge, he spotted something unfamiliar. A plastic medication bottle and a handwritten note. Take 2 every 4 hours if needed. G. Had Granger been here while he slept? Or had she brought these with her when she wheeled him back from the surgery? He couldn't remember her doing anything in his room besides embracing him. But maybe she'd already dropped off the medication earlier, while he was being seen by Dr. Adkins. Forward thinking. He picked up the bottle, read the contents. These pills were stronger than any you could get over the counter in an English pharmacy. But the pain he felt was not in his flesh. He checked for new messages from B. There were none. The ghost of Bing Crosby was talking when Peter walked into the mess hall. Mucous membranes and a larynx that had once nestled in a human throat, long since dispersed into the soil of Holy Cross Cemetery in Los Angeles, had made some sounds that were captured on magnetic tape in 1945. And that tape, digitized and lovingly reconfigured, was being broadcast through the cafeteria's public address system. The dozen or so USIC personnel scattered around the armchairs and tables were oblivious, carrying on their conversations, or simply focusing on their food and drink. The disembodied voice of Judy Garland, smaller mucous membranes, vibrating more excitedly, joined Crosby's in a rehearsed off-the-cuff routine about trying on hats, intended to epitomize the gulf between men and women. Stanko, behind the coffee bar, switched on the smoothie machine, drowning out the ancient voices under a whir of crushed coffee-flavored ice. "What's good today, Stanko?" asked Peter when his turn came. "Pancakes." Bing Crosby, having interrupted the flow of Garland's prattle,
had started singing.
"Anything savory?"
Stanko lifted the lid on a metal vat, releasing a hearty smell.
"Beef stroganoff."
"I'll have that, and a mug of tea." Stanko handed Peter a plastic plate of richly hued steaming food, a plastic beaker of hot water, a paper sachet of dairy powder, and a tea bag with a minuscule picture of Buckingham Palace on the tag.
"Thank you," said Peter.
"Enjoy, bro."
"Looks good."
"Best stroganoff you can get,"
affirmed Stanko, deadpan.
Sardonic humor? Maybe he was on the level. Right now, Peter doubted his own ability to judge.
He walked to a free table. There was just one left, and sat down with his meal. While Bing Crosby pretended to annoy Judy Garland with chatter about golf, Peter began to eat the beef, which he knew was white flour that had been pounded with a stone and then dried and fried. The sauce tasted wrong. Too sweet, too cloying. Fragments of young white flour stalk had been dyed bright orange to resemble carrot, and there were blanched slivers of half-mature white flour leaf that were supposed to be onions. He wished Usyk would ditch these faked concoctions and just eat white flour the way the Shishkoda ate it. There were so many good, wholesome recipes going unused here.
"Mind if I sit here?"
A real, living female voice in competition with a dead, long-ago one. He looked up. It was Hayes. He motioned her to go ahead, apprehensive that she would ask him how he was. A question he wasn't sure he could answer without breaking down and telling the whole story. But as soon as Hayes took her seat, it became clear that she was only interested in the surface of the table, to rest a thick book on. Glancing at the pages as he ate his food, Peter identified the patterns of Sudoku, Kakuru, Hitori, Filomeno, and other mathematical puzzles, neatly completed in pencil. Hayes bent over the book with an eraser clutched between her thumb and forefinger. With fastidious care, she began to rub out the pencil marks. 5 minutes later, Peter's plate was empty, and Hayes's iced coffee was untouched, forgotten. She was hunched over, absorbed in her task. Her mouth was slightly open. Her downcast eyes had soft, luxurious lashes. She impressed Peter as prettier and more soulful than he'd previously thought. He was touched, deeply moved all of a sudden by her altruistic labor.
"That's very considerate of you," he heard himself say.
"Excuse me?"
"Very community-minded."
She stared at him, uncomprehending. "Rubbing out the pencil marks," he explained, wishing he hadn't spoken. "It gives other people a chance to do the puzzles."
She wrinkled her brow. "I'm not doing it for other people. I'm going to do these puzzles again myself."
And she returned to the work at hand. Peter sat back and drank his tea. Hayes's serene focus no longer struck him as attractive. Instead, there was something creepy about it. Okay, he wasn't a puzzle man himself, so the appeal of filling in those squares was already mysterious to him. But he appreciated that it presented a pleasant challenge for other minds. But doing the same puzzle over and over? A burst of laughter from the other side of the room failed to disturb Hayes's concentration. It came from Tusker, Manili, and the guy who'd escorted Peter back from the settlement. What was his name? Conway. They appeared to be playing a game of rudimentary magic with three plastic cups and a rivet.
"How'd you do that? How'd you do that?"
Conway kept saying, to Tusker's delight. Elsewhere, USIC personnel reclined in armchairs, flipping through fly fishing, classic cartoons, Vogue, and The Chemical Engineer. Peter remembered Tusker's Légion Étrangère lecture.
"It's best if you've got a team of individuals who can deal with being in permanent limbo. People who won't go crazy."
Maybe Hayes was a prime example of a person who wouldn't go crazy. Someone who did her job, caused no trouble beyond a few pages torn out of a lesbian porn magazine, and, when she retired to her quarters, could while away the hours and days and months on perpetually erased puzzles. Of Crosby's fabled modesty that he was able to describe such a sublime work of art as fluffy and a novelty, the DJ was intoning. We'll now hear an unissued alternate take.
listen out for Bing stumbling on the word annuity and other evidences of inadequate rehearsal. Worth it, though, for the slightly closer proximity of Garland to the microphone, allowing us to fantasize that she's right in the room with us.
"Sorry to interrupt you again," said Peter.
"No problem," said Hayes, rubbing out just one more numeral before looking up.
"I was wondering about these music broadcasts. Are they old?"
She blinked, then opened her ears to register the sound.
"Very old," she said. "Those singers, I don't think they're even alive anymore."
"No, I meant, are these shows with the announcements and everything put together by someone here at USIC, or did they already exist?" Hayes cast an eye around the mess hall.
"Rosen does them," she said. "He's not here right now. He's a surveyor and a draftsman. You've probably seen his drawings of the centrifuge and power facility displayed in the projects hall. Awesomely accurate work. I still stand and look at it sometimes."
She shrugged.
"His music I can take or leave. It's background noise to me. I'm glad he likes it so much. Everybody's got to like something, I guess."
She didn't sound convinced. A fresh flush of pain went through Peter. The memory of B's message again.
"The mother," he said, trying to get a grip.
"Excuse me?" "The nickname you suggested for the centrifuge and power utility."
"Facility," she corrected him with a smile.
She closed her puzzle book and slipped the eraser into a pocket of her shirt. "Nobody calls it the mother, I know that. They still call it the Big Brazier, or actually the BB. Preparing to leave, she hugged her book to her bosom.
"No sense getting upset. As my mom used to say, don't sweat the small stuff.
When in distress, don't self-obsess, reach out." B's motto. Their motto as a couple, actually.
"Do you miss your mom?"
Hayes hugged her book tighter, reflective.
"I guess. She died a long time ago. She would have been proud of me, I'm sure, being chosen for this mission. But I had a good job already when she died, so she was proud already. It's not like I was a deadbeat."
"I was a deadbeat once," said Peter, maintaining eye contact.
"Alcoholic. Drug addict."
Hayes was the wrong person to share such intimacy with. He knew that. But he couldn't help himself. He was, he belatedly realized, in no state to be here at all among these people. He needed to be unconscious, or among the Shishkoda.
"It's not a crime," said Hayes in her unemphatic monotone. "I don't judge anybody."
"I committed crimes," said Peter. "Petty crimes."
"Some people go through that before they straighten out. Doesn't make them bad people."
"My father was terribly disappointed in me," Peter pushed on. "He died a broken man."
Hayes nodded. "It happens. You work here for a while, you find out that lots of your colleagues have got real sad case histories. And some haven't. No two stories alike. It doesn't matter. We all get to the same point."
"And what point is that?"
She raised her fist in a gesture of triumph. If triumph was the right word for a fist so loosely clasped, so amiably raised, so unlikely to be noticed in the context of this convivial cafeteria. "Working toward the future."
"Dear Peter," wrote B at last, after he had spent what felt like an eternity in prayer and worry. "I'm sorry I didn't respond for so long. I don't want to talk about what's happened, but I owe you an explanation. Thanks for reaching out to me. It doesn't change the way things are, and I don't think you can understand where I'm at now. But I do appreciate it. A lot of things led up to this. Our church has hit a setback, to put it mildly. Jeff has absconded with all funds. He and the treasurer were having an affair, and they've flown the coop together, no one knows where. But the accounts are cleared out. They even took the collection bags. Remember how we prayed for God's guidance to choose a pastor to replace you? Well, Jeff was the one. Make of that what you will. Opinion is divided on what to do next. Some people want to sort out the mess and try to keep it going, and some feel we should just start afresh with a new church. They even asked me if I would be pastor. Brilliant timing.
2 days before this fiasco, I started back at work. I thought it would be bliss with Goodman gone. But the place has changed. It's filthy to begin with. The floors, the walls, the toilets. No cleaning staff and no prospect of getting any. I pulled out a mop and got busy on one of the bathrooms, and Moira almost bit my head off. "We're nurses. We're not here to scrub floors," she said. I said, "What about staff? What about open wounds?" She just stared me down. And maybe she's right. The workload is bad enough as it is. A&D is pandemonium. People running around unsupervised, shouting, scuffling with the orderlies, trying to wheel their sick mums and dads and kids up to the wards before we've had a chance to triage them. All the patients are poor now. Not a single well-educated middle-class specimen among them. Moira says that anyone with money has abandoned the NHS completely. The rich ones defect to France or Qatar. The average folks find themselves a nice walk-in paper service clinic. There's loads of them springing up everywhere. Whole new communities are forming around them. And our hospital gets the dregs. That's Moira's word for them. But to be honest, that's what they are. Stupid, boorish, loud, ugly, and very, very frightened. Forget about Caritas. It's a struggle to even keep your cool when you've got a drunken lout with blurry tattoos yelling straight into your face and jabbing you in the shoulder with his nicotine-stained finger. It's an endless parade of bloodshot eyes, acne, smashed noses, slashed cheeks, cracked ribs, scalded babies, botched suicides. I know I used to complain that Goodman was trying to fill our hospital with easy cases, but there is a difference between offering all levels of society access to medical care and letting an entire hospital be overrun by a pig-ignorant mob. Time has run out on me. It's 6:30. I have to go to work now. I haven't even told you what happened to make me finally snap, but it's hard for me to face it myself. And writing takes so long, and I didn't know I would write this much about other things. I thought I would just come straight out with it. But it will cause you so much pain, and I wish so much I could spare you that pain forever. I must go now. Love, B. At once he responded. Dear B, I am so worried about you, but relieved to hear your voice. It's true that we all misunderstand each other. Only God has perfect understanding. But we shouldn't let the grief of that frustration stop us trying. My work with the Oasens confirms this over and over. The news about Jeff and our church is deplorable, but the church does not consist of Jeff or the treasurer or a particular building. This setback may prove to be a blessing in disguise. If we owe money, we can repay it, and even if we can't, it's only money. What goes on in the hearts and souls of human beings is the important thing. It's encouraging that our congregation wants to start afresh with a new church. Ordinarily, people are terrified of change, so this is an amazing example of courage and positivity. Why not start a simple fellowship in someone's front room, just like the early Christians? Complicated infrastructure is a luxury. The real essentials are love and prayer, and it's great that they want you to be pastor. Don't be angry. I think you would do a superb job. Your comments about the changes at the hospital are only natural given the increased stress, but they confirm my sense that maybe now is not the time for you to be working. You have a baby growing inside you, or at least I hope you do. Have you had a miscarriage? Is that what's shaken your faith in God? I'm worried sick. Please tell me. Whatever it is taking you to a very bad place spiritually. Those pig-ignorant people who are crowding into your hospital, are all precious souls. God doesn't care whether someone has acne or bad teeth or a bad education. Please remember that when you met me, I was an alcoholic waste of space, a deadbeat. If you had treated me with the contempt I deserved, I would never have been rescued. I would have just got worse and been proof that types like me are beyond redemption. And who knows? Some of the women you're seeing on the wards may have family traumas not a million miles away from what happened to you. So please, no matter how hard it is, try to hang on to your compassion. God can make miracles occur in that hospital of yours. You say yourself that these people are frightened. Deep down, they know they desperately need something that medicine can't give them. Write as soon as you can. I love you. Peter. Kikrush was finally going down, turning the horizon golden caramel. There would be a drawn-out dusk of almost wearisome beauty, and then it would be night for a long, long time. Peter stowed the putrefying oasen food in his bag and left the compound. He walked for a mile or so, in the hope that the Usyk base would disappear from his view, or, more to the point, that he would disappear from the view of anyone at Usyk who might have seen him leave. But the flat, featureless terrain meant that the buildings remained obstinately in sight, and the trick of perspective made them seem less far off than they were. Rationally, he knew it was highly improbable he was being watched, but instinctively, he felt under constant surveillance. He walked on. The direction he'd chosen was westward into the wilderness. That is, not toward the Oasen settlement, and not toward the Big Brazier. He'd fantasized that if he walked far enough, he would eventually reach mountains, streams, or at least some rocky knoll or marshy bog that would let him know he was elsewhere. But the tundra went on forever. Level brown earth, occasionally enlivened by a clump of white flower luminescing in the sunset. And whenever he turned to look back, the eerie concrete mirage of the Usyk base. Tired, he sat down and waited for Kikrush to sink below the land. How long he waited, he couldn't tell. Maybe 2 hours. Maybe 6 hours. His consciousness detached itself from his body, hovered above it, somewhere in the Shachsh. He forgot the purpose of his coming out here. Had he decided he couldn't spend the night in his quarters and opted to sleep in the open air? His knapsack could serve as a pillow. When it was almost dark, he sensed he was no longer alone. He squinted into the gloom and spotted a small, pale creature about 5 meters away. It was one of the bird-like vermin that had consumed the white flower harvest and bitten him. Just one, separated from the rest of its kind. It waddled cautiously in a wide circle around Peter, nodding its head. After a while, Peter realized it was not nodding, but sniffing. Its snout smelled food. Peter recalled the moment when the flesh of his arm sprayed blood, recalled the nauseating pain of the bite to his leg. A convulsion of anger disturbed the numbness of his grief. He considered killing this vicious creature, stamping on its body, grinding its sharp-fanged little skull under his heel. Not in revenge, but self-defense, or so he could pretend. But no. The thing was pathetic and comical, hesitant in the dark, vulnerable in its aloneness, and the food it smelled was not Peter's flesh. Slowly and smoothly, Peter extracted the prize from his knapsack. The creature stopped in its tracks. Peter laid the plastic bag on the ground and shuffled backward. The creature moved in and punctured the bag with its teeth, releasing a sweetish stench. Then it gobbled up the entire pile, plastic shreds and all. Peter wondered if, as a result, the creature would end up dying a more horrible death than if he'd stomped on its head. Maybe this was what the Hindus meant by karma. After the satisfied animal had left him, Peter sat and stared at the distant lights of the base, his home away from home, as Granger had called it. He stared until the lights turned abstract in his brain, until he could imagine the sun rising in England and Bee hurrying through the car park of her hospital toward the bus stop. Then he imagined Bee getting into that bus and taking a seat amongst a heterogeneous variety of humans. Some chocolate brown, some yellowish, some beige or pasty pink. He imagined the bus traveling along a road crowded with vehicles, until it pulled up in front of a store that sold household knickknacks, cheap toys, and other bargains for 99 pence, round the corner from a street with a laundromat on the corner, 150 meters from a semi-detached house with no curtains in the front windows, and an internal staircase carpeted in threadbare maroon, leading up to a room in which stood a machine on which Bee could, when she was ready, type the words, "Dear Peter." He raised himself to his feet and started walking back. "Dear Peter, no, I have not had a miscarriage, and please don't lecture me about compassion.
You just don't understand how impossible everything has become. It's all about the scale of a problem and the available energy to deal with it. When someone gets their leg blown off by a bomb, you rush them into surgery, mend the stump, fit them with a prosthetic, give them physiotherapy, counseling, whatever it takes, and a year later, they may be running a marathon. If a bomb blows off their arms, legs, genitals, intestines, bladder, liver, and kidneys, it is different. We need a certain proportion of things to be okay in order to be able to cope with other things going wrong. Whether it's a human body, or Christian endeavor, or life in general, we can't keep it going if too much of what we need is taken away from us. I won't tell you about the other things that were freaking me out in the last week or two. It's current affairs stories that will only bore you. New wars in Africa, systematic slaughter of women and children, mass starvation in rural China, crackdown on protesters in Germany, the ECB scandal, my pension being wiped out, stuff like that. None of it will seem real to you up there. You are spooning Bible verses into the hungry mouths of Oasens. I appreciate that. Anyway, what you need to know is that last week, for various reasons, I was stressed out. And as usual, when I'm stressed out, Joshua picks up on my vibes. He was cowering under the furniture, dashing from room to room, crying, circling round and round my shins, but not letting me pick him up or stroke him. It was the last thing I needed, and it was driving me crazy. I just tried to ignore him, get on with some chores. I ironed my uniform. The ironing board was at an awkward angle, and the cord didn't have enough slack, and I was too tired and hassled to set it up any other way, so I just coped. At one point, I set the iron down, and it fell off the edge of the board. Instinctively, I jumped backward. My heel came down hard on something. There was a sickening, cracking, snapping noise, and Joshua screamed. I swear he screamed. Then he was gone. I found him under the bed, trembling and hyperventilating, eyes wide in pain and terror. I'd broken his back leg. I could see that. There was not one iota of trust in his eyes. He flinched when I spoke. I was the enemy. I fetched the gardening gloves so that he wouldn't scratch or bite me, and I took hold of his tail and pulled him out. It was the only way. I got him into the kitchen, put him on the table, and attached the lead to his collar. He was calmer. I thought he was in shock, maybe in too much pain to do anything except sit there panting. I picked up the phone to call the vet. The kitchen window was open as usual. Joshua shot out as if someone fired him from a cannon. I looked for him for hours. I covered the same ground over and over until I just couldn't walk anymore and it was pitch dark. Then I had to go to work, night shift. It was hell. Don't say anything, it was hell. At 4 a.m, I was wearing two hospital gowns because my uniform was covered in feces. An obese, insane guy had been tossing it out of his bed, smearing it on the bed rails, bellowing the place down. The orderlies were off duty. It was just me, little Oyama, and a new girl who was sweet, but kept disappearing. The feces-tossing guy's mother was camping out in the visitor's room through the night. Nobody had been able to throw her out. She's in there with a six-pack of Pepsi and some half-eaten takeaway. This is supposed to be a hospital. And every so often she pops her head in and checks that we're taking good care of her boy. "You a bitch," she yells at me. "You cruel. I call police. You're not a real nurse. We're the real nurses." On and on and on and on. In the morning I go home, still wearing the two gowns with the cardigan over them. Must have looked like an escapee from a loony bin. I get out of the bus two stops early so I can cut through the park in case I find Joshua there. It's a long shot, and I don't really have any hope that I'll see him. But I do. He's strung up by the tail from a tree. Alive. Two kids of maybe 12 are hoisting him up and down on a rope, making him spin, jerking him so he twitches. A red haze falls over my eyes. I don't know what happened next, what I did to these kids. My memory is a blank. I only know I didn't kill them because they weren't there anymore when I came to. There's blood on my fists, under my nails. I wish I killed them.
Yeah, I know. Underprivileged kids, rotten upbringing, in dire need of love and forbearance. Why not come to our outreach program, blah, blah, blah. These evil scumbags were torturing Joshua.
I pick him up. He's still breathing, but shallowly. The base of his tail is shredded, and one eye looks gouged out, but he's alive, and I think he recognizes me. 10 minutes later, I'm at the vet's. It's before opening hours, but I must have kicked and screamed because they open up for me. He lifts Joshua from my arms and gives him an injection.
Okay, it's done, he says. Do you want to take him home or leave him here?
What do you mean, take him home? I say. Aren't you going to do anything for him?
I just did, he says. Afterward, he tells me he had no way of guessing I was willing to pay any amount of money for surgery. Nobody's bothering with that sort of thing nowadays, he says. I can go for 5-6 hours without anyone coming in, and then when someone finally walks through the door with a sick pet, all they want is for it to be put to sleep. He puts Joshua into a plastic bag for me. I won't charge you, he tells me. Peter, I'm only going to say this once. This experience is not educational. It is not instructive. It is not God moving in mysterious ways. It is not God figuring out exactly what sublime ultimate purpose can be served by me stepping on Joshua's leg and everything after. The Savior I believed in took an interest in what I did and how I behaved. The Savior I believed in made things happen and stopped things happening. I was deluding myself. I am alone and frightened and married to a missionary who's going to tell me that the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And if you don't say it, it would just be because you're being diplomatic. Because in your heart, you're convinced I made this happen through my faltering of faith. And that makes me feel even more alone. Because you're not coming back to me, are you? You like it up there. Because you're on planet God. So even if you did come back to me, we still wouldn't be together. Because in your heart, you'd still be on planet God. And I'd be a trillion miles away from you. Alone with you, by my side.